congratulations are due to Precious Metals aficionados and to Chicago Cubs fans. The medals blasted to one-month high, and the 108-year wait ended this week with the Cubs finally winning the World Series. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak. It's great to be back with you. We've got another big show and two more big guests, including best-selling author Harry S. Dent Jr., who has another bestseller, Sale of a Lifetime. You can pick up the book for free with $5 in shipping costs. He has ominous warnings for investors, especially regarding the Dow Jones, which he thinks could drop 75% from around 18,000 to 3,800. And it certainly had a good start this week. Then Axel Merck from Merck Investments returns with in-depth analysis on the economy and the currency markets. He says the two-year dollar rally might be a little more than a short squeeze. Inflation is ratcheting up, which is holding the real rate of interest in negative territory, a near-perfect world scenario for precious metals investors. Our guest suggests gold ownership to increase diversification as the perfect asset for offsetting U.S. equities risk, and the discussion includes cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. And we've created our own Bitcoin alternative, you might say, Goldbit and Goldcoin, Silverbit and Silvercoin, and GoldSeekCoin. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with a big editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals market for the third week running. Gold advanced, closing higher on the week by $28, up 2%, above that psychological support level at 1304. Silver added 58 cents, closing at 1837 an ounce, 3%. The precious metals XAU shares added 4 points, 5%, finishing at 89. And black gold was off about $5, though, bucking the trend down just less than 10% per barrel, closing above 44. But that was on the heels of the CRB commodities index sell-off, and both seemed to be approaching solid support. Gold held near a one-month high as investors sold the U.S. dollar in favor of safe haven assets ahead of next week's American presidential election. Increased expectations of higher U.S. interest rates simply wasn't enough to buoy the greenback. The odds of a December meeting increase in rates has risen now to about 78, almost 80%, sharply higher than last week, according to the Fed Funds Futures contract. Bullion posted its third weekly gain. That's the longest run since the Brexit in July, when the UK voted to leave the European Union. Meanwhile, according to a Labor Department report on Friday, U.S. job growth increased by a seasonally adjusted 161,000 in October, following September's upward revision of 191,000. The report was viewed as strong against the backdrop of declining national unemployment, which fell about 0.1%, down to 4.9% from last month's 5% figure. The labor force participation rate also edged lower, so all of this encouraged precious metals investors. Holdings in the gold-backed exchange-traded funds climbed about 2 metric tons to 2,045 tons as of Thursday, that according to Bloomberg.com. Precious metals bottom line, clearly it was the dollar sell-off that held sway over the markets this week. Was that due to stronger-than-expected numbers, or the even closer race for the presidential election, which of course is decided next Tuesday? Strong dollar selling certainly pushed investors into gold and silver. Then, of course, this is a positive seasonal time as we have the holidays approaching next month. Moving on to the Wall Street report, heavy clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange as volatility continued much higher amid increased uncertainty over the outcome of next week's elections. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped 273 points off 1.5%, ending at 17,888. The S&P 500 fell 41 points, about 2%, ending at 2,085 for the week, while the NASDAQ dropped about 144 points, 3%, finishing at 5,046. In related news, the average hourly earnings increased about 3% in October compared to a year before, representing the best growth since June of 2009. The recent Fed statement released this week was somewhat dovish, much more so than many economists had expected. Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen noted indications of some overheating in the economy, and the fact that the economy is apparently firing on all cylinders indicates that Fed officials will likely raise rates next month as expected, and that, of course, that lowers the relative attractiveness of stock dividends. Bottom line on U.S. equities. Well, the VIX Volatility Index blasted higher as anticipated in the last market weather report, and fear is also at extreme levels. Clearly, investors are doing a bit of panicking here ahead of the November 8th election. We did see some signs of capitulation, but the market did close also near the lows, which suggests there could be further selling next week. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with our two big guests and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. My featured guest today penned a new book, The Sale of a Lifetime. You can actually receive a free copy of the book. You just pay for shipping and handling. It's a pleasure to welcome back Harry S. Dent, Jr.
Oh, hi. Nice to be back, Chris.
Sale of a Lifetime. Of course, this is your latest in a long series of bestsellers. Maybe you could just give us an overview.
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's probably my most accessible book. My editor really did, I think, a great job breaking it into smaller chapters and bite-sized nuggets and making it very clear. So I was very happy with that. And the whole point of the book is that, you know, we've been keeping this bubble going with quantitative easing, and it's showing signs of really starting to crack up. I mean, the China crash last year, and, you know, Italy's got huge bad loan problems. Greece is still bankrupt. Deutsche Bank, one of the largest banks in the world, and so, you know, we're showing signs that this bubble's just not sustainable. So the big question is, what do you do as an investor? And our whole point is, look, you're going to see, just like in the early 30s, you know, in 1932, 33, you could have bought anything and made money for decades and decades, because that's the lowest point in real estate and commodities and stocks that anybody would have seen in their lifetime back then. And that's what's going to happen here. The difference is, this time around, once we go through this inevitable kind of financial crisis and debt and bubble deleveraging, the world's not going to be the same. In other words, most developed countries are aging rapidly. The United States is one of the best in demographics, and we just go sideways for the next generation. I mean, the next generation does not take us to new heights in the number of people who will be peak spenders and buy houses and enter the workforce and do all this sort of stuff. And so investors are going to have to be more selective. The real home runs are going to come in the emerging world, especially the next China, which is going to be India. And it's not going to be China, at least for a long time, because China's overexpanded their infrastructures and real estate by 10 to 15 years, and their demographics fall like a rock. They're already falling, but their demographic trends fall much more rapidly about the time we come out of this, you know, early to mid next decade. So it's going to be in emerging countries, especially places like India and Southeast Asia, and it's going to be in commodities, because these emerging countries both are big exporters of commodities, and they're the biggest consumers of commodities. They tend to spend a much higher percentage of their incomes on commodities. For example, India, it's 60% spent on commodities. China, it's 40-some percent. The United States, it's like 6 to 10%, depending on how you count it. So we look, you know, where do you invest? Where do you do business once we get to this crisis? And between now and then, you've got to protect the capital that you built up in this unprecedented bubble. I mean, everything's overvalued, except now for commodities, who've already crashed 70% or more. But real estate is higher than ever in a lot of places, and stocks are at new highs, at least in the large cap markets in the United States. They're not in Europe or Asia or Japan or anywhere else, or even China, but they are here. So you have to protect your assets first, and then there's going to be a series of opportunities. I think the first is going to be long-term bonds. The bond bubble is going to burst, but then deflation is going to be a strong wind behind bonds. I think they're going to go to darn near zero again because of deflation, and then, you know, emerging countries and commodities, and then stocks and the best arenas, like the aging arenas of the developed world in the United States. And we even show there's countries like Australia and Sweden, that have very strong generations to follow the baby boom, whereas most countries it's much weaker. So we look at the whole world and tell, you know, how to protect your assets now, and most importantly, where do you invest? Because there's going to be a narrow window in all these arenas where you're going to have the opportunity to buy investments or make investments at prices you will never see again.
You talk about John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Joe Kennedy. Many of these folks are well known for their huge wealth that they created during their lifetimes. And you say that you've identified and quantified their secrets. Obviously, you can't give away anything proprietary, but can you give us a hint?
What smart investors do is they understand that no matter, I mean, you can say Facebook's the greatest company ever and going to grow a zillion times, but so did General Motors, and General Motors got clocked 90% between 29 and 32, even more than the Dow. And even though it became the greatest company in the world and it was the leading company at the time, so because of this bubble, even the best companies and the best real estate gets overvalued, and smart investors don't buy stuff when it's super expensive. When a lot of people think you can't lose money with Manhattan real estate or San Francisco or Vancouver, and you can't lose money buying, you know, Amazon or Apple or Facebook, but you can. You lose the most money because the greatest assets bubble up the most, especially in the late stages. So the smart investors realize this. They sell. The richest family in China has been selling all of their commercial real estate as fast as they can for the last 2 years. That's what the smart money does, and then they turn around and have the courage to buy when there's blood in the streets, as they say, when things look so bad. You know, imagine how bad the world looked in July 1932 when stocks were bottoming, or March 33 when real estate was bottoming. People would thought, oh my gosh, I'm never going to buy anything again. That's when the smart investors step in and buy long term again, because again, the prices don't stay there very long. Stocks went straight up after 32, and real estate went straight back up, and so you have to see it coming. You have to preserve your cash and cash flow so you can take advantage of it, because nobody's going to lend you money, and your assets are going to be devalued, so you won't have much money. And then you got to act decisively in the book, how bubbles tend to go back to where they started to go exponential. So you can also gauge in advance in any real estate market or any stock or stock market, okay, when have we finally erased the bubble? And that's when you can start buying. And don't buy until then. Most people are you know, the market's going to go down 30%, and then all these analysts can come out and say, oh my gosh, this is great. Oh, this is the time to buy all these stocks. And they're just going to be too early, because bubbles don't correct. They burst. And they tip a stock. Stock bubbles tend to go down 70 to 90%. Same with commodities, 80 to 90, and real estate, like 40 to 60. So you have to start seeing those sort of numbers, declines, before you step in. Too many, most people will never step in, and then many others will step in too early, thinking this is just another, you know, 20, 30% correction. This is not going to be a 20, 30% correction, especially after they stretch this thing this far. I mean, this has been 8 years of stretching up markets with bad fundamental trends, and just all on stock buybacks and quantitative easing and zero and negative interest rates. This is not a real economy. And so stocks at some point and financial assets are going to have to reset with that reality.
Exactly. And, you know, we also have the trends, obviously, the BOJ and the ECB and several others with excessively low interest rates. And that just drives more and more capital into New York, into the United States. But you're talking about wiping out virtually trillions of dollars in assets here.
We've got one graph, and it shows there's approximately $300 trillion of financial assets in the world globally. You know, that's loans, bonds, stocks. That's not even counting real estate, but loans kind of reflect that partially. $300 trillion. We could see, I estimate that at least $120 trillion of financial assets and loans will be wiped out, and that's going to cause a huge deflationary spiral in the economy, because you got less money and wealth chasing the same goods and financial assets. So this is something like this only happens once in a lifetime, and it happened in the early 30s. That's the last great reset, the last deflationary shock to the economy, the last global bubble burst, and it was devastating to assets, and nobody saw it coming. In the late 20s, everybody thought we were on a plateau of prosperity, just like now. People think, oh, quantitative easing, we'll get over this crisis, and then we'll just grow. I just debated somebody the other day that said the Dow's going to go to 200,000 in the next two decades. I'm like, the Dow would be lucky to get back, after it crashed, back to where it was at the recent peaks ever in the rest of this century unless demographic trends change, and they're not going to change until we start living to be 100, 120, and that's going to happen at some point, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. So, you know, demographics say the developed world is fully urbanized, and demographic trends in 9 out of 10 developed countries are sideways at best long term and down at worst from Japan to Germany. Germany actually has, we show in this book, the worst demographic trends in the next several years, worse than Japan saw in the 90s. And in Japan in the 90s crashed, even though the rest of the world had the greatest boom in history, which we alone forecast back in 1988-89 in my first book. We said Japan's going to crash 12 to 14 years, U.S., Europe, the rest of the world is going to see the greatest this decade, even better than the roaring 20s. And that's what we got. That was just demographics saying that. Extraordinary numbers of baby boomers accelerating in their spending, internet and personal computing moving mainstream on an S-curve. These are things that happen at predictable times in history. They're not unpredictable. They're not only not unpredictable. When they crash, they're not black swans. Everybody, when there's a major crash, they say, oh, nobody could see that kind of black swan. No, bubbles build predictably, as we show in this book, and they crash predictably, and they crash typically in stocks twice as fast as they exponentially build. So the downside is much more tricky than even the upside in bubbles. So that's why you just can't afford to wait and see if the bubble burst, because we also show that in the first 3 months of most major stock bubble bursts throughout history, including the Roaring 20s burst in the early 30s and the Nikkei bubble in the early 90s and the tech wreck and all this sort of stuff, half the damage, 40% typically, 40 to 45% drop will happen in the first 2 to 3 months when all of a sudden the smart money runs and you know, and even the best stocks crash. So it's very dangerous. And a lot of people think, well, yeah, but the market just kind of keeps edging up, so why don't I wait and see? In a normal correction, you can do that. A normal bull market peak, you can do that, and you can wait for the first drop and wait for about a 50% retracement of that and then get out of the market. That doesn't happen when most bubbles burst. It's just lightning.
You know, you make an excellent case for a market peak, plateau of prosperity. Of course, Professor Fisher, right around the Great Depression. I know there will be listeners saying, this is an excellent case. It's outlined, it's bulleted perfectly. Nevertheless, in recent weeks, we did see a new zenith in U.S. equities. How do we rectify that?
Chris, you really can. I mean, the best example I heard a speaker say was, you know, you can drop sand on the floor, grains of sand, one at a time, it'll form a mound. That mound will get steeper and steeper, and you can tell when it's about to burst, but you can't tell which grain of sand. One grain of sand will cause an avalanche in that mound, and that's what happens with bubbles. This thing's going to burst because it's so ridiculously high given such poor fundamental trends. I mean, all this quantitative easing in Japan still growing at zero on average, in Europe 1% at best, and us 2% at best. I mean, what does that tell you? How would we be doing without $12 trillion of free money injected in the economy and negative and zero interest rates? So it has to burst, but there's no way to tell. It could be already peaked. It could peak a month from now. It could peak early next year. I'm just seeing signs of more things cracking. What's going to happen at some point, something like the subprime crisis, because that was just a trigger, is going to go wrong, and it's going to cause this avalanche faster than central banks can print money. Because, remember what I said earlier, I calculate at a minimum about $120 trillion of wealth and financial assets and loans are going to disappear over the next couple of years. So are the central banks going to print $100 to $120 trillion to offset that? I don't think they're going to be able to get away with that or do it fast enough. I think they're going to have a hard time convincing people that in the next crash that they should go do the same thing that already failed.
Let's outline another scenario here. If we see the powers that be do everything they can to prop up the markets, perhaps we could see something similar to Venezuela, which is unraveling right now. You have its stock market. I mean, it was a remarkable rally as inflation took off, which is just the opposite of what you're calling for, really what amount to almost Great Depression, like I would assume deflation.
You can get inflation in isolated economies like Venezuela or Zimbabwe or things like that. But, you know, major economies, you know, when you see a debt bubble and a financial asset bubble burst. Literally, money disappears. It disappears at the speed of light. Less money chasing the same goods is the classic definition of deflation. So that's the way this ends up. There was inflation in Iceland when they devalued 20% a year for a couple years. That's the pain they had to build. But you know what? Their economy turned around after that and has been doing better than the rest of Europe because they deleveraged the debt. They defaulted on their foreign debt. Their exports increased again from devaluing the currency, and they got back into balance after a couple years of painful inflation. But the general theme, especially for major countries like, you know, United States, and we've already seen this in Japan. Japan's been printing money at three times the rate of Europe and the U.S. at best, and they have zero inflation. So what would they have without printing that much money? They would have deflation. And at some point, they're going to go into deflation too. But I think that, to me, if there's an alternate scenario, it would be more like Japan. Japan never had a banking crisis, never had, you know, deep deflation and debt deleveraging, but they've been in a coma economy growing at 0% with zero productivity and zero inflation. I mean, they're dead. They did. Quantitative easing was able to prevent the banking system from melting down, as obviously occurred in the 1930s. So that's my alternate scenario, is that the whole Western and developed world just goes into a coma living on endless quantitative easing.
Officials are seriously considering free income or permanent income for every single individual.
Helicopter money. They're just going to start, instead of, they've been giving all the money to the banking system to keep it liquid and afloat, because otherwise these guys would be bankrupt terribly. But yeah, they're saying, and you know, I'm saying, hey, if you are going to do quantitative easing, at least give it to the people, because they should spend some of it. But it's still not a good thing. Free money causes the economy to get perverted, causes excess capacity, people to overbuy, overborrow, and that just sets you up for a bigger crisis down the road. So I don't like free money.
That's a good transition, I think, into the quantitative easing. If you take a look at St. Louis Fed's numbers, obviously we had roughly $800 billion on their balance sheet. Of course, that all changed right around 2008, well, halfway through 2008, 2009. We trebled up to about $2.4 trillion. And that number, of course, doubled again by 2014. There's been an interesting plateau of Fed spending. It has held virtually constant from 2014 all the way through 2016. For your thesis to really play out, we would likely have to see the Fed either hold pat or start to backtrack on their balance sheet. Is that something you're expecting?
Well, they're more likely to hold pat. And you know, they're talking about raising interest rates a quarter of a point. They almost have to do that in December unless the economy gets suddenly weak because they put it off so long. But I think that's going to be the last rate rise you see. And they're going to be talking about resuming quantitative easing. My question is, if we start to see a global crash after $12 trillion of printed money and zero and negative interest rates for so many years, if we crash again, is hard or worse, are people going to believe in, well, why don't we go do the same thing again that failed? I think it's going to be a hard sell. And one of the reasons the dollar's been stronger than other currencies like the yen most of the time and the euro is that we're the best house in a bad neighborhood. Yeah, we printed a bunch of money, but hey, we stopped in 2014. And like you say, we're holding. We're still doing some quantitative easing because they have to buy the bonds that mature to replace them to keep up at this $4.5 trillion level. But it's very modest compared to what Europe's doing and Japan and China. It created more debt in the world than all of the other major countries together in the last year. China's just gone bonkers and their real estate's gone. So they're China's dead. That's another big sign to me, Chris, is I see China is definitely in a blow-off phase of the bubble in real estate, and they have the most extreme bubble, especially in their tier one and leading tier two cities. And it's just going to blow at some point. And when it does, China's going to see the fastest destruction of wealth because the Chinese have 75% of their net worth in real estate, two to three times what we have. We have anywhere from 25% to 35%, depending on when you measure. After it went down, it's less. But Japanese are totally invested in real estate. And the funniest thing I just saw, there was an article said that Shenzhen, which is now the most overpriced city, surpassing Shanghai, Silicon Valley of China, right near Hong Kong, that now a single person there with about a $15,000 U.S. income has to pay $132,000 for a 66-square-foot, they call it, closet condo with a fold-down bed. $132,000 when you're making $50,000. So you're paying 8-9 times your income.
You have outlined this on almost every show, and you deserve some recognition for that. The more I read between the lines on virtually every article from that region, more skyscrapers than any other country in the world. And if that doesn't start to make the bells ring a bit, wait a minute, we've got some serious froth here. And you also talk a lot about Japan, which still is reeling from the 1990s bubble, the Nikkei, you know, and it still hasn't fully recovered.
Even at its best, Chris, it only got up to 21,000, a little over half of what it was at the peak, and now it's heading down again, and it's going to see 7,000-8,000 again. That's an 80% drop, and again, that's what you should expect when a bubble bursts. Not 30, not 40, not 50. 80% is typical for stock market bubble burst, and in 1929 to 32 was actually 89% in the Dow. I mean, just so 80% plus is what you should expect, and you know, I got people that always saying, oh, Harry, how can you say stocks will go down? But, well, we've already seen two bubble bursts, and the next one's going to be even worse. And when I warned about commodities and oil going down to $10 to $20 a barrel years ago, and people said, Harry, that can't happen. It's already happened. Oil's already seen 26, and it's falling again. And if we have this downturn, it's going to fall much more. And this is what bubbles do. Commodities and stocks crash 80% plus when a bubble bursts, not when a normal bull market peaks like in 1972, then they crash maybe 50%. This is what you should expect. So this is not something to sit through and not something to let your stockbroker talk you out of doing. Get your money out and protect it. Give up another 5 or 10% or whatever this market may, if it's really lucky, have left in it, and just preserve your money and sleep at night and just wait to cash in on the sale of a lifetime. It's that simple.
That's true, but and we talk about bubbles and you talk about frothiness, but what will stop our policymakers at the Fed and their colleagues from doubling and tripling their balance sheets to offset a potential another credit crisis similar to 2008-2009?
Well, they are going to try. That's what they're going to want to do. They're going to want to do more of the same. The question is, can they do it fast enough? Because, again, the United States is talking about raising rates and normalizing. To go back to strong quantitative easing is going to be a very difficult backpedaling, and they're going to lose a lot of credibility, both, as I said earlier, because the bubble burst anyway, despite quantitative easing. And then, you know, they're saying they need to normalize rates, and now they want to go back and print trillions of dollars here. I think even if they do it, and you got to remember 2008, they did do it, but we already saw a major crash in the deepest recession since the 1930s before the quantitative easing could hit and turn around and save the banking system. So we still got a major crash, and we still got a major recession, even though they did quantitative easing to levels nobody would have thought. Even the liberal economists weren't predicting, you know, that just everybody would pull all stops out and just print money at the highest rate in all of history, and everybody buying back their own bonds. I mean, isn't that cheating? You go into debt, you stimulate the economy, you go over into debt, and then you buy your own bonds to keep the yields down. This is like so absurd that one of these. I mean, and most economists think this is okay, and Warren Buffett thinks it's okay. So I'm telling people, don't listen to Warren Buffett either. He may be one of the best investors in history, but you know what? He started his fund at the bottom of the last major long-term correction around late 74, early 75. You could have thrown darts and made a ton of money. Maybe not quite what he's made, but you could have made huge returns if you'd have just started then and kept buying stocks. That's simple.
Yeah, we don't want to disparage him, but at the same time, you're right. You know, during 2008-2009, the identical percentage as the market as a whole, which I think is indicative of just not solid investing strategy. We've talked about America. We've talked about China. We've talked about Japan. We haven't said too much about the Eurozone. You say the Brexit might just be the beginning, that perhaps something even more ominous looms on the horizon for that region.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think by early next year, Italy is going to be in a very difficult position. They may have to leave the euro just to devalue like Iceland, because they're not going to get a bailout. There's no way Germany's bailing Italy out, because it's just too big to bail out. And then that brings up Greece and Cyprus, you know, and all these other, and Portugal has got, you know, a lot of bad loans. And Deutsche Bank is the riskiest bank now in the world. They have only like 2.68% capital against their financial assets because they've lost so much money on bad loans and investments. So I think you're just going to continue to see the euro and the eurozone break up. More countries will leave. And Catalan wants to break off from Spain, and Scotland's thinking about breaking off from the UK. I think the U.S., and I'm serious about this. People really think I'm crazy when I say this. I think the United States is going to be more like the Civil War. I think it's going to be red states versus blue states. There's no room for compromise. And I think the country could split into two or more. And in that revolution probably be led by Donald Trump with, if and when he loses, which he's likely to, and he doesn't have to be presidential anymore, and he'd just be a rabble-rouser, and he can start his own Trump TV cable channel with his media partners. He's the guy that gets the most eyeballs in the world. He's like a World Series or something. So I could see this country having something like the Civil War, where a large group of red states just say, we can't stand, we're not dealing with this debt thing anymore, we're not dealing with transgender and all these social issues that they, you know, fight against. I think we could see a major split in the United States. I don't know exactly how it works out. I think Brexit is the beginning of what I call the end of globalization. That we had a big surge in the 1800s, and we had a bigger surge after World War II, and we've got another one coming before the whole world, you know, developed emerging countries are fully urbanized and more middle class. But we're going to backtrack. People don't realize that global trade as a percentage of GDP went from 40% at the beginning of World War I down to 10% at the end of World War II with the Great Depression in between. We had 33 years of a collapse of globalization. I think that is what Trump is running on. Globalization is now the enemy, not a good thing anymore, and it's killing our jobs, killing our country, and everybody's thinking like that. And when everybody thinks like that, global trade contracts and everybody loses.
Just ask anyone in the manufacturing sector of the last decade, 15 years, they've lost on average 500,000 top-paying jobs per year. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a good solid 6 million at least of our manufacturing jobs gone forever. And what's ironic is these people who think that a strong leader can suddenly magically bring back those jobs, I think are mistaken here.
Everybody's going to retaliate. That's what happened in the Great Depression. There were tariffs put up, and when everybody puts up tariffs, it's just like quantitative easing. When everybody's doing quantitative easing, then you don't have any advantage. Only when somebody like Japan does it more. And I tell you, one thing I do agree with Trump on, I would slap a tariff on Japan so fast. I mean, because they are cheating by constantly pushing their currency down. They're just plain out cheating. China and India are cheating by having huge pollution and not paying the cost that other countries pay to, you know, and they're polluting. I would put a tariff on them, and I wouldn't do it to penalize trade. I would do it to say, look, if you're cheating, we will only calculate a tariff to offset the degree you're cheating. We want better trade, but I'm just telling you, I've only got this insight after I wrote the book, frankly, that globalization is peaking for now, and it's going to take decades of realigning countries and regions around more natural, religious, ethnic, political, financial lines. I mean, like the Middle East, where's all the wars and violence? Where there's mixtures of Sunni and Shia. The rest of the Islamic world doesn't have all these wars like Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan do, because they're just Sunni. You know, they don't have anything to fight over. But in those regions, there's mixing. You got Iraq has three major religions in it, and there's no way to unite that country. Iran's going to end up taking over the Shia side of Iraq, and Syria and the Sunni side of Iraq are probably going to somehow merge somewhere down the line. And the United States might be better off, at least for a while, being the red states and the blue states, so they can have common policies that they agree on. There's no way to get the Tea Party to agree with the liberal parties in this country. It's not going to happen. And that's why Congress can't get anything done. It's totally divided, totally polarized. It's more polarized than the 1920s and 30s, where we had the greatest income inequality up until now. It's more like where we were coming into the Civil War, where the North and the South had nothing in common in political, social view. And they were two different economies, an industrial and an agricultural.
There is another example where polarized concepts and groups did come together, did band together, and that was World War II, where there was a united threat. Wouldn't surprise me at all if the powers that be tried to, you know, manufacture some type of external threat that everyone is facing. But maybe that's a topic for another discussion. You do bring up an important topic for all or most of our listeners, and that is, what is your house really worth? You pose the question, but you say you should sell now. Why should we sell now?
Well, first of all, to get reality, look, I say go back to where the bubble started. And that's not all the way back to the lows in real estate or at any point in time. When did it start to go up exponentially? And I calculate that as January of 2000 for real estate in the United States and pretty much around the world, given a few years or so. Look at what your house is worth in January of 2000. That is your downside potential, roughly. And then, again, when I was moving from Miami to Tampa in late 2005, when I was calling for a peak in the real estate bubble and everybody thought I was crazy, I told my wife, here's our downside potential if we buy a house in Tampa, an upscale house, 70%. And that was enough to convince her, okay, we'll rent. Probably the house we got in dropped 50% in the first 2 years we were in Tampa. And it's going to drop again. But that's the best benchmark. Bubbles tend to erase the bubble part, just the exponential part that was never warranted in the first place. And you know, stocks would have to go back to late 94. That's when stock bubbles started, that whole run from late 94 into early 2000. That was the greatest bubble since the roaring 20s. And to erase that, the Dow would have to go back to 3,800. That's a lot. Would you want to hold out for an extra 5 or 10% gains in stocks when that's your downside? And then half of that, 40 to 45%, could come in the first 2.5 to 3 months before you even, like, this is dangerous stuff.
But I know there has to be the listener out there saying, wait a minute, if I'd thought this a few years ago, you know, many individual stocks in particular have had remarkable explosive growth. And maybe I should keep some portion of this in my portfolio in the event that things don't exactly go according to plan.
But yeah, anything people do, if you have a vacation home, in a primary home, sell the vacation home. That's more expendable, and you can buy one later if things crash. And you may want to keep the residence if you want to live in it forever. And you may want to keep some stocks. But anything you do to reduce your exposure to risk, it just makes sense when things are so highly valued. I mean, if you throw away my whole book and demographic research and all my cycles and just look at models, which are independent, that say if you buy stocks now at these valuations, like 27, you know, price earnings ratios, that you're likely to make minus 2% for the next 10 years. So that cumulative, you can lose 20 to 30% without a crash, without a downturn, without bad demographics, without bubbles bursting everywhere, just because you bought them at high valuations. It makes sense to reduce risk when stocks get so high valued. And in real estate, is off the charts, especially in the hottest areas like downtown Manhattan. I mean, we're the next penthouse condo coming on the market, $250 million.
I mean, I'm sure you're aware of this and our listeners as well, that, look, we've got these retirees who are desperate for income. There are very few places where they can derive said income. I mean, folks are living 85 years, 95 years. There's some talk that our current newborns now might be facing 100 years or more as their average lifespan.
True. It's one of my biggest arguments that why we're going to have to restructure entitlements. People now tend to retire on average at age 63 and then live to 85. The life expectancy 79.6 or something like that. But if you make it to 63, you live longer. And if you make it to 73, you live longer. So we're way out of sync. You can't work for 43 years entering at age 20 on average and then retire on the dole for 20-some years. You can't do it. It's not affordable. We're going to have to start retiring increasingly towards 75, and we're going to have to adjust for entitlements, health care and Social Security and stuff, in line with our continued increasing life expectancy. And at some point, we're going to have a jump. We're going up at a year and a half a decade. At some point, it's going to start jumping 4 to 5 years a decade. That's like it did to the 30s through the 60s.
But, you know, that's a tough sell.
When do labor unions cave in and finally cut their pensions or the benefits in half? They bankrupt the companies.
The sale of a lifetime. Please tell people more how they can find out about the great bubble burst of 2017.
Yeah, just go to saleofalifetime.com. We've been having a hard time keeping it in stock at Amazon, so better to go to our website. And we are, like you said, offering to send the book for free if you just pay $4.95 in shipping, and that's like real cost. So, you know, you can also find out more about our broader services at dentresearch.com. Thanks, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing can contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
My featured guest today says the end of dollar hegemony is unfolding. Investors must prepare for an entirely new investment ontology. Axel Merck, President, Chief Investment Officer of Merck Investments, Manager of the Merck Funds, innovator in gold and currency investing, and author of Sustainable Wealth. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Since the end of World War II, the greenback emerged as the de facto global currency. You say, though, that borrowing costs could soar in the United States.
I'm not in the camp that the rest of the world is going to conspire and just, hey, we'll dump our dollars. For that, you've got to really have a belief in authority that people are able to coordinate things. I'm much more a believer that the road is paved with good intentions, meaning everybody is out there for their own good and is trying to do what they think is in their interest. Now, you might wonder, why do they want to keep those reserves and so forth? But I'm specifically referring to, in my latest analysis, to some of the dynamics that have been playing out. And most notably, if you think about it, for example, if somebody is raising money in the U.S. as a plant manager in an emerging market, well, they might raise dollar debt, and then they will sell the dollars to buy the local currency. And so then the government that doesn't want the currency to appreciate has an incentive to counter that. Now, all that said, why is it that the plant manager wants to raise the money in the U.S. to begin with? And that's where this analysis is really at its core. I claim that this is due to some quirks that have been around in the money market fund industry. And most notably, if you use your money market fund, well, you think your money is safe, right? And so money market funds invest in short-term commercial paper and other short-term debt that isn't really, quote-unquote, completely safe. It's not backed by the government, but that has been the perception. And regulations until a few weeks ago have kind of encouraged that sort of vision. And with that, those that have issued debt have had an advantage, meaning lower borrowing cost when they were raising money. And now as these rules are changing, what I believe is happening is that, well, not just foreigners, but others as well, might think twice whether they should really raise all this money in USD. And in my view, that's going to have seismic changes as the world is adjusting to a world where that implicit subsidy is vanishing.
It's interesting because the world is adjusting now at a rapid clip. And you point out the yuan, of course, recently added to the official basket of reserve currencies, SDRs. Now, you say this is a clear sign that there is an end of dollar dominance, that folks may have their wires crossed here, that the prevailing view might not be correct. Could you tell us more?
There has been a lot being made about the Chinese moving to a reserve currency basket is really what's going to change the world. And timing-wise, they might actually be right, because those changes in the money market fund rules happen to coincide with the Chinese adding the yuan as the SDR. To me, that's just a symptom of how the world is shifting. Again, everybody is in there for their own good. The IMF, of course, has been trying to be relevant for decades now, and now they elevated the Chinese yuan to be reserve currency. Remember, most countries, and none of the big countries, do not manage the reserves according to the SDR basket. Indeed, when that basket was recently changed, the dollar weighting barely changed. The yuan was increased at the expense of the yen and the sterling and the euro, mostly. Kind of a change from one day to the other. But it's a perception change, by all means. This happened to coincide with a change in money market rules, and I should be more specific. It's institutional money market funds that are not government funds. And the change where you see that isn't so much in the yuan trading. Where you see it is in the LIBOR rates. The LIBOR rates are the intrabank borrowing rates of banks that don't have access to the Fed. And so typically you refer to the kind of the borrowing cost in London between banks, and they have been rising in recent months or even in recent years as people have been getting ready. And so the stress that's in the system, as some people call it, is really just a repricing that investors no longer have access to this free cash from money market funds. If I can take a step back here for a moment, in 2011, half of money market fund holdings, of prime money market fund holdings, were in U.S. dollar denominated commercial paper by European banks. Remember, we had this little Eurozone debt crisis? Half the holdings. There's one major brokerage firm that had, we looked it up, this was hiding in plain sight, 75% of its holding in commercial paper issued by European banks. And so, and those numbers have shifted since. There's higher quality in there. It's not just European banks, but it shows how important money market funds are to others, to European banks funding, and not just European banks, to all corporate issuers, to sovereign debt issuers, all kinds of players. And because that free ride that they have been getting has been going away, the funding costs, the increase, LIBOR rates have been increasing, and that is the key, in my view, how the world is shifting. Now, what's happening in China is a very interesting sideshow, and clearly what the Chinese are doing is hugely relevant in the long run. But for the time being, the kind of the threat of the dollar dominance, I don't think it is something that's decided by the policymakers, but it's been a quirk in the regulations that kind of artificially subsidized everybody who wanted to get dollar funding. And now, as that is phasing out or has been phased out, well, now why would you want to raise your funds in USD? You can raise them in euro. Think about it. Many corporations now issuing euro-denominated debt. Now, obviously, that's exacerbated by the fact that it's much cheaper to borrow in euros because the rates are negative or lower, at least, than they're in the U.S. And so that has been exacerbating that trend. And so something like the SDR, I think, is a wonderful sideshow, but the real thing is happening right in front of our eyes in the money markets.
The U.S. dollar, although many top pundits are saying that this is a new uptrend, of course, the dollar has been stronger for about 2 years now, and decidedly so. You even point out that it's approximately 2 standard deviations above the longer-term moving average, which, of course, is more than the norm. This all has implications, obviously, for the precious metals market.
Yeah, no kidding. That being more than standard deviation, more than 2 standard deviations beyond the long-term moving averages is not exactly the norm. So, yes, I do think the dollar is a bit overbought here. What exactly it means? Well, it's an excellent question. In the long run, I can tell you, in the long run, it means that more funding will take place in local currencies, which is ultimately healthier for the global financial system. Long term, the dollar is going to be less relevant, and long term, it means that all borrowers in the U.S., and I would think even the government borrowers, meaning the U.S. Treasury, is going to have to pay a higher cost. And because I don't think we can afford a much higher cost, the Federal Reserve is going to keep rates artificially low, which means you're not going to get compensating for U.S. dollars appropriately, and that is going to weaken the dollar in the medium to long term. Now, what it means in the short term is a far more difficult question. And the reason I say that is that there are so many different people using the dollar for so many different purposes. I mentioned the corporate hedger before. Well, from a sovereign, from an emerging country. Well, that sort of, if they borrow less in USD, the only impact you might see is that foreign governments might do less to kind of sterilize the inflows that come otherwise to these emerging markets. And we've seen that the reserve holdings of some of these emerging market governments have been decreasing. I don't think that's a coincidence. It's not just a quote-unquote flight to quality. There's less of a need to that. So we see some of that. That doesn't have a direct implication for the currency. But if you're not hedged, if you just borrowed in USD before, well, borrowing money in a currency is akin to shorting a currency. And so if they stop borrowing money in the USD, that's actually going to help the dollar upward. And so I think part of the kind of the rise in the USD we saw until the end of last year, and by the way, since then it's been on the decline, that may be that was the period where we had a quote-unquote dollar squeeze. But of course, there are others that use the dollar differently. And so in the short term, the amounts are enormous. I don't think anybody has a clear picture what it means. But in the medium to long term, it means the dollar is going to be used less for funding purposes. And that has other implications. Remember, we have this flight to quality. The dollar is supposed to benefit. Well, if you look at in recent times, the euro has tended to benefit much more when there's a flight to quality. The euro has become a funding currency. And by the way, the yen has been benefiting less so. That doesn't mean the dollar can't benefit anymore if there's a true crisis somewhere. But still, those dynamics are changing. They're changing in front of our eyes. And many people, if they don't pay attention, might just not notice it.
You discussed this idea that perhaps this is a dollar squeeze. We don't know for sure, but you raised the point. In the Merck Perspective Insights, you give one compelling bullet as to why that might be the case. Everyone's focused on dollar strength, but has anyone really taken the time to look at the competing currencies? Many of these currencies within, you know, the SDRs might be putting in a bottom. I mean, after all, we have record negative rates. We're seeing this in Europe and the Bank of Japan, as well as Sweden and a few other peripheral nations.
Well, the first topic on the dollar squeeze, and there I have my own view. In fact, we have battles inside our office of whether I'm right or wrong. I happen to believe that dollar squeeze might be done and was overdone with at the end of last year. Now, others are arguing this could take much, much longer, and I'm not going to try to settle that discussion here right now. But the other point here, and you alluded to it earlier, if you look at the long-term dollar average, and with long-term, I'm talking about a three-year moving average, we are really 2 standard deviations above the long-term average, which means, if nothing else, the dollar isn't cheap right now. And the reason why the dollar isn't cheap is because we got this expectation we're going to have these rate hikes going up. Well, many people think when U.S. rates go up, the dollar goes up. Well, if you look at history, there is just no proof on that. Historically, the dollar has increased in anticipation of the first rate hike. When the U.S. actually starts hiking rates, the historic picture is far more mixed. And indeed, this is exactly what has happened this time around as well. The dollar was rallying into the first rate hike we had a year ago, at the end of last year. And then, since then, it's been a much more mixed picture versus the major currencies has actually gone down. And so part of that is, of course, because A, we have priced in a lot of hikes. And if you've noticed, hey, if we do one 0.25% rate hike every 12 months, that doesn't mean we are exactly, quote unquote, tightening. In fact, I would allege that inflation is creeping up more by 25 basis points a year. And so on a real basis, rates actually are going down. And so that brings me to the point that you're raising here. I actually think we are closer to the top of the rate cycle in the U.S. And now, if you look at the rest of the world, take Europe. Many of these policies haven't worked. You throw more negative interest rates at the market. That stuff just doesn't work. But that also means they're not effective at easing. And indeed, Mr. Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, has said that the fragmentation in the Eurozone is done and over with. Mission is accomplished. Now, you can argue that that's not right, but that's a sign that they may not push down the accelerator further, that indeed they might be closer to the bottom of the easing cycle. So if you put those together, that we are closer to top in the U.S. and closer to the bottom in the Eurozone, and that, quote-unquote, everybody thinks the dollar is going to go up, well, I'd love to take a contrarian point of view on that and saying, well, maybe, just maybe, we're going to see the dollar weaken from here on forward.
Move on here. You point out almost a perfect world for the precious metals, at least in terms of U.S. investors. Inflation is strong and real interest rates are essentially contained by inflation. Is that not a positive for the metals? And do you see stronger or better times ahead?
Well, sure. First of all, I'm regulating anything that I say, so I am not allowed to say we have a perfect world for something. To me, there are two key reasons why one wants to invest in precious metals and gold specifically. One is just for diversification, and I think that's a battle that most people agree to. The correlation of gold to equities, for example, in the long run is just about zero. Doesn't mean it's not correlated on any specific day, but from a correlation point of view, gold is clearly a diversifier. Now, the question always is, how is gold going to perform going forward? Is there a positive return expectations? How can this brick that doesn't do anything have a positive return expectation? And historically, it has had it, but how about going forward? And to me, the prime competitor to gold is cash. If cash pays you a real interest rate, meaning that after inflation pays you a return, then cash is a competitor. And that is why in the early 80s, when Paul Volcker hiked interest rates to the stratosphere to around 20%, the price of gold came down quite substantially. So if you think we have a Paul Volcker Fed that is going to have very high real interest rates, I would stay away from gold. Now, I happen to think that real interest rates continue to hover near zero, and obviously it depends a little bit on what inflation gauge one is using, but I just don't see also how in the long term we can afford positive real interest rates. I can't see it in the U.S. I can't see it in the Eurozone. I can't see it in Japan. I can't see it in England, by the way, either in the U.K. And so those are the sort of reasons why I happen to think that gold might do just as well going forward as it has done historically. Doesn't mean it's always going to go up, but since 1971 or so, the return of gold has been on an annual basis about 8%. Now, I don't know whether gold is going to return 8% going forward, but I happen to think the odds of gold performing well going forward are about or at least as good as they have been in the past. And the past returns have been quite attractive on a risk-adjusted basis. And so that's really kind of, without getting too emotional about it, why gold, in my view, has a role to play in people's portfolios, and why the fact that it doesn't return anything doesn't really, as far as kind of you don't, it doesn't produce anything, doesn't bother me, because cash really doesn't return anything either if you don't put it at risk. And it does, of course, raise the question, maybe the quote-unquote bad thing here is the cash rather than the gold.
We see the Fed funds futures really discounting any rate hikes in 2017, and therefore maybe nothing higher than 75 basis points in this December, at the December upcoming FOMC meeting at most. So again, investors clearly agree with your sentiments there and your thesis. And lastly here, cryptocurrencies. You know, in your hometown there, at least the office area, that region, you have another business professional, the venture capitalist, Mr. Draper. He's made some rather startling puzzling forecasts and projections for Bitcoin. Mr. Draper believes that we could see six digits on this currency in the coming years, and that it even perhaps directly competes with the yellow metal and other currencies around the world, and has some very interesting and unique qualities as well as some weaknesses. Any thoughts?
Bitcoin to me is a very intriguing technology. And what I love about Bitcoin is the decentralized ledger. Now, for that very reason, authorities don't like it. What authorities are very concerned about is that people can trade something and there's no trace, that they don't know how to deal with anti-money laundering issues. And by the way, that's the same thing, of course, with gold. You can trade a gold coin or gold bar and there's no trace of it. But because it's an electronic world, authorities want to do it. Now, back to kind of how relevant that is, in my view, something like the Bitcoin technology will have amazing applications. I can see it being used for trading airline miles. I can see it being used for all kinds of things. What I haven't wrapped my head around it is why somebody would want to hold what is ultimately a delayed debit card that's fluctuating wild in value. So the Bitcoin incarnation as is, to me, isn't a quote-unquote currency. It is a wonderful vehicle if you're in China and want to get money out of the country. It's a wonderful vehicle if you want to send money long distance, if you're willing to take the risk that the value is fluctuating, although nowadays there are some Bitcoin derivatives that take that sort of risk out of the equation. So to me, Bitcoin is a stepping stone in a good direction. It's vastly different from gold, although it does have some very intriguing features. I think the technology is going to stay with us. I think in a few years from now, I think we will talk about something other than Bitcoin, but that other thing will have elements of that same technology. So it's a fascinating topic. As far as the quote-unquote appropriate value for Bitcoin, I have no idea.
There's roughly 21 million Bitcoins in total, which were embedded into the blockchain that is, of course, in public domain. And therefore, there is no central bank. There's no ability, I guess, for policymakers to manipulate, at least not at this time. They might try to regulate it at some point.
Anything that's successful is going to get regulated. And so that's why we don't know in which direction this is going to go. And the advantage gold has a couple of millennia in history of how people have regulated it, with some of good and the bad. And so we kind of know what to expect and what to be afraid of. With Bitcoin, there are many unknowns there. That doesn't mean there's no value there. But it does mean that there's a lot more that we as investors and that engineers and technology folks and that hackers, by the way, as well, will need to learn in how to work with Bitcoin.
You know, Satoshi, the nom de plume or the pseudonym for the individual who at least hypothetically engineered Bitcoin, is on record that I don't know where Bitcoin will be. So he shares your sentiment that we just can't quite see the future when it comes to this, but it's intriguing nevertheless. Any parting comments or any other topicality that we've missed today you'd like to share with the listening audience?
I think we've covered a great deal. What I can encourage any listeners to do is follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Axel Merk, AXELMERK, or sign up to our free newsletter at merkinvestments.com. Learn about what we do. We address these sort of topics all the time. We work a lot with gold and then obviously, as you pointed out, try to make sense of the world of currencies.
Mr. Merk, always informative. Look forward to a further commentary in 2017.
All right. My pleasure.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Make no mistake about it, regardless of who wins the U.S. presidential election, the United States and the world at large are sitting on an economic keg of potential disaster, with expanded debt, mega unfunded liabilities, the specter of negative interest rates, massive government entitlements in response to reckless fiscal policies that have destroyed once productive corridors of the economy. All of these and more have long been predicted to hit the fan, so to speak, ever since the 2008 financial collapse occurred. But through the magic of quantitative easing, extend and pretend, and a mainstream media narrative that speaks to only about 75% of our population who are still engaged in the economy, while statistically ignoring the 25% of those who are truly unemployed for a myriad of reasons which are never discussed openly, honestly, or as the official reality. Because if they did, those mainstream media commentators might be branded as peddling economic fiction. But we are learning through WikiLeaks and an expanding public conversation that has been dragged kicking and screaming into the mainstream media spotlight that the only fiction that has been peddled has been the official narrative that we have been asked, or rather told, to swallow. Not to mention a national health care plan that commoditizes the delivery of what used to be the art and science of medicine. And certainly not to mention the growing reports and examples of digital censorship from all major media platforms against those who dare discuss anything with a large enough audience that extol the virtues of the individual over the collective. And in the process of censoring those individuals, those media platforms conveniently forget that the smallest minority group on this planet is the individual. And when they take actions suppressing individual thought, whether they agree with it or not, they are censoring and suppressing everyone. Remember, it's not the politics, the philosophy, the art, or the music that is ever in question. It's always the freedom of expression. The day of reckoning that all of this portends is Election Day. And just like when one graduates from high school or college, it's called commencement, which refers to the beginning of a journey, not its conclusion. This election will be much like a commencement exercise. It will represent on a scale like no other election before it, two very different views of the world, two very different views of America, and at its core, two very different views of the individual. Already both sides have lawyered up. Some reports indicate with thousands of lawyers ready to contest whatever results are generated on November 8th. Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Clarence Thomas hearings, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, Al Gore's Supreme Court challenge of the 2000 presidential election will all be a cakewalk compared to the chaos that is about to be unleashed as the new norm for American political life. The distractions, disruptions, and dislocations that will become the backdrop of our news and political process for the next 4 years will be occurring during what I believe will be a time of major financial reckoning for unresolved debt issues both in the U.S. and globally. This great reckoning is long overdue, but many will confuse the cause of this great financial reckoning with the effects and fallout and political show that is guaranteed to result from the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and join my new email list. I've been gearing up for some time now to release new content and special features, which are just around the corner. So please, direct your browser to conquerchange.com and sign up today. Updates will follow shortly. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. Bank and founding director. Their Sal George project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Rhea project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.